We go. Okay, good evening, and thank you very much for joining for a session on the Shoteh, Judaism and the Irrational Patient. I want to thank Shari Shamayim, as well as the Bayit for partnering on this, and the Nussbaum family for dedicating our medical ethics and halacha program. I want to thank Dr. Barry Pakis for arranging CME credit and generally consulting on all of this. I'm just going to mute people because I've got some background noise. I'm going to also thank Dr. Kirshen for his help with a particular vignette in the program this evening. I'm glad to see people with their screens on. I really appreciate it. Makes it a lot easier for me. I am not recording video. I am recording audio. Our next session is scheduled for Monday, May 15th. I need to have some classes for the lawyers coming up in the next couple of months. So the next medical one is Monday, May 15th. It'll be at 8 p.m. that night, God willing, on dealing with difficult patients. So that's the topic for that one. Registration for that should open probably sometime around Pesach. I put the link in the chat several times before. I'm going to put it in again because people have joined for people to download the source sheet if they did not get it in an email in advance. I do need you to sign in if you want to get CME credit. The fact that you are here and your name is showing on the screen is not adequate in order to be able to get credit because I'm not writing down who's here. I need the record that's in the chat. In the event that you're already getting the emails, I don't need your email address. I just need you to actually enter your name indicating that you were here. There's also an evaluation form. Evaluations are important for us in terms of our accreditation through the University of Toronto. The link for it is on the sheet. It's the first link in the links section on the sheet. Also, if you registered by, I think it was Thursday, then you'll be getting an email later this evening from Dr. Pakis with that link. And also, when I send out my follow-up email from the class, the link will be there as well. In the evaluation, you will be asked to suggest topics for future classes. I gave you on the sheet a link for our archive of past medical sessions so you can see what we've already addressed. Okay, and with that, let's begin. So I put the agenda for the session on the source sheet. As usual, I will read it out. This is the agenda we submitted to the University of Toronto. For more than 2,000 years, Jewish law has sought to define incapacity for purposes including executing transactions and participating in religious ritual. The chief example of the incapacitated person is the Shoteh. But what are the defining traits of a Shoteh? Do they have parallels in modern psychology? Is the Shoteh a useful model in determining a patient's capacity for consent to treatment? So I hope to address those points and quite a bit more. On the sheet, I gave you links for past sessions which relate to the topic at hand. We had multiple sessions, actually, in 2012 on capacity to consent. But the one that I gave you the link for was kind of an abridged collection of points on that. Also, we had a session in 2014 on Judaism and dementia care. We had a session right before COVID on mental health, and mitzvot. And then finally, our most recent session on eating disorders. All of those are relevant for the discussion. As I've said before many, many times, I'm going to say it for sure for this session. Each case that comes up, each practical case that comes up with these issues is a shaila. It's a real halachic question for which one should consult a competent rav. Please do not go based on the things that we say this evening. We're raising issues. We're discussing them in what I hope is a responsible way. But every case needs to be addressed individually. This shiur is actually a legal shiur rather than a medical shiur. In the sense that we're not going to be discussing a lot of the medical science behind somebody being irrational. We're talking about how we assess a patient's behaviors and understand how Jewish law interprets those behaviors in terms of things like halachic obligations, one's ability to engage in transactions, marriage, divorce. But fundamentally, those are questions of Jewish law. It's a question of how Jewish law responds to a medical situation as opposed to the definition of a medical situation. It's much like in English when people note that the word insane is not a medical term. It's a legal term. It's a question of, is this person we see in front of us qualified for whatever issue is involved? Because of that, if you take a look on your sheet at the third source on the front page, the one right after the set of links, this comes from an article which I'm going to quote multiple times in the course of our session, called "The Shota and Psychosis in Halacha with Contemporary Clinical Applications" by Dr. Raul Strauss. Some of you may have been there in 2017 when we had a session at Shari Shamayim, a panel discussion on eating disorders. Dr. Strauss was visiting from Israel at the time. He's with Mayanei HaYeshua in Israel, and very active in the sphere of mental health and mental illness. And in this article, which appeared in the Torah Umada Journal, he writes, after outlining the essential symptoms characteristic of a shoteh and associating these symptoms with the contemporary description of psychosis, which he has done earlier in the article, we must now clarify who ultimately diagnoses the shoteh. Rambam deals exclusively with the issue of a shoteh serving as a witness in a court of law. What he means by that is not that Rambam only talks about shoteh in the context of witnesses. However, it's in the laws of testimony that the Rambam discusses what determines a shoteh, what the criteria are. That's where he does it. And in such cases, Rambam concludes that it is the responsibility of the dayan, the religious court judge, and the beit din, the court itself, to understand the witness's predicament and then apply that knowledge in deciding whether he is capable of serving as witness. This may very well be a fundamental requirement that in judiciary matters, it is the judicial system that is required to investigate a person's health status and then apply the related halachic norm. It's up to a court. It's up to a judge, not a doctor. In a different sphere of halacha, however, it is conceivable that the intervention of the Beit Din is not required. In most spheres of halakha external to the formal judiciary, the responsibility of determining halachic outcome lies with the lone rav posek. What he means by that is, if the question is this person in front of me obligated in mitzvot? Is this person in front of me eligible to perform marriage or divorce? That's going to be the question that the rabbi is going to need to respond to. So therefore, in the varied cases of shoteh definition, the relevant halachic authority will be required to perform in a manner corresponding to that of the Beit Din and Dayan in judicial cases. But fundamentally, the assessment is going to lie with judge. The assessment is going to lie with the rabbi, both of whom are going to have to rely on the doctors to give them a lot of medical information, as we're going to see in the course of our session. You can't do without the doctor. But that's why I say that this is really a legal question as opposed to a medical one. Is that point clear? You follow what I'm saying? Okay. So I gave you vignettes on the sheet, but I don't want to discuss them yet. I want to get into the definition of a shoteh first and then come back to the vignettes, which I hope will illustrate and highlight different aspects of the shoteh situation. So before we go any further, I just wanted to ask whether there are questions or comments, and then we'll proceed after that. But I want to make sure that that we're not coming into this with questions that should be addressed first. No, we're good? Okay, then let's go forward. How halacha deals with the shoteh. First of all, I want to note, before we get into some of the law about assessing that somebody is a shoteh, I wanted to spend a little bit of time just showing how Jewish law demands that we take care of somebody who has been determined to be a shoteh. So the shoteh has all sorts of personal protections within Jewish law. For example, their confidentiality must be protected. You can't say this person is not rational, not sane, to use the secular term, and therefore they're not entitled to that protection. It's not so. Their confidentiality must be protected. A woman who is a shota being the feminine form of shotel, though no one really uses it, a woman who's in that category may not be divorced. The husband is not allowed to divorce her. That's an example of a personal protection. Their property is protected. One is not allowed to harm them. One is not allowed to steal items that they find and claim for themselves. The rabbinical court, the local rabbinical court, will have an obligation to appoint a legal guardian for their property in the event that there isn't already somebody taking care of it on their behalf. They are exempt from mitzvot. However, they are also still very much Jews. And there's an interesting passage, the Talmud, when it codifies that last rule, says that a Jew is not allowed to go to another Jew who is a shoteh, and therefore exempt from mitzvot, and ask them to do something on Shabbat that the competent person is not allowed to do. In other words, you have a situation in which you have somebody who is competent, who is obligated in the laws of Shabbat, and the air conditioner is off. So they go to the shoteh and they ask him to turn on the air conditioner. So that's not allowed. One may not do that. The Talmud says, because this person is still Adam, this person is still a human being. And the Rambam, when he codifies it in the laws of Shabbat, chapter 20, halacha number 7, says that not just they are Adam, but they're Adam Yisrael. They are considered a Jew, and you can't ever forget that. And there's more to discuss about their rights and protections, but I at least wanted to make sure that we begin by noting that they have a range of protections that are meant to look after their interests and ensure that they're not harmed or abused. So what exactly is a shoteh? The word shoteh itself is spelled shin vav tet hey. That's the way that the word is spelled. I've seen some suggest that the origin of this term shoteh is from the term shot, shin tet, which refers to drifting, like drifting on the water, like on a raft. It's that kind of a situation. Or sat, sin tet. The sin and the shin can, in certain circumstances, interchange. Sat is to deviate from, like deviating from the norm. So it could refer to that as well. The cases of the shoteh appear all over the Talmud and in various areas of Jewish law. We've already mentioned it affects their responsibility to fulfill mitzvot. It affects their ability to perform mitzvot for others. So a shoteh will be ineligible to serve, let's say, as a shochet, right? A ritual slaughterer. Blowing shofar would be an interesting question. Can they blow shofar on my behalf? They're standing in court to serve as witnesses. Their ability to engage in commerce and have their transactions upheld. Their ability, as we said, to marry. Their ability to divorce. One thing that's very important to keep in mind, and I said this in the eating disorders shiur, is that calling somebody a shoteh is both kula and chumra. It's a leniency and a stringency. A person shouldn't think, you might say to yourself, if I can find a way to label this person a shoteh, they're exempt from mitzvot, and that will help them. That's not necessarily a benefit to them, because it also means that potentially they're unable to have marriage or divorce or legal transactions. So you say, well, I want to make sure that they're able to do those things, so I'll say, let's err on the side of not labeling them a shoteh. But then that means they're obligated in mitzvot. There is no clear-cut leniency or stringency in this regard. What is lenient in one way is stringent in another. So that's something to keep in mind. Clear so far? I'm not going to... So that's where we're going next. That's literally the next point. Good question. I like the question. Any other issues before we launch into what the definition actually is? Because you're right, we haven't gotten there yet. We've just said irrational/insane. We haven't gotten to the meat of it yet. So
it's not a reminder. In the Torah, we don't have the word shoteh.
Correct. We do have the word meshuga, but we do not have the word shoteh. That is true. So shote is a condition in which one's actions reflect irrationality. And I stress it's about actions as opposed to an underlying pathology. I refer you back again to Dr. Strauss in source number 3 in his article, where he says, as opposed to being a diagnosis rooted in pathophysiology or abnormal cognition, the term shote reflects a phenomenological classification. It's about what you observe, with the responsibility of competence assessment and optimal categorization lying with the Beit Din, as we've said, which takes into account the encouraged input of mental health professionals. You are going to talk to the professionals about it. You need their assessment. However, it's based on what you can see of the patient's activity. It's not about what's going on inside the patient's mind to a certain extent. We're going to come back and modify that in a little bit, so don't get too stuck on that idea. I also quoted for you Dr. Rachamim Melamed Cohen. I gave you a link in source number 4. It's for a little bit about Dr. Melamed Cohen, who passed away a while ago. If anyone has not heard of him, he's someone to hear about. He was a very accomplished educator, and then he was diagnosed with ALS, Lou Gehrig's disease. And he ended up, after he was already basically immobile, using his eyes to be able to write, and he published 10 books in this state.
I gave a lecture about him.
Really? Okay.
He painted with his eyes.
He also painted, that is also correct. Yeah, he painted using his eyes as well. Graphic design. Really a remarkable, remarkable person. So he has a book called Hayeled HaCharig VaChinuch HaMiyuchad Al Pi Mikorot BeYahadut. Right? The Atypical Child and Special Education Based on Jewish Sources. Great book. Very worthwhile read. So he writes in source number 4, Be'od sheha'agada matzbi'a berov ha'mikrim ala shote kecharig b'machshava. He says, if you look in agada, meaning rabbinic writing that is not about law, but that mentions a shote, it usually talks about the person's thought process being irrational. However, he says, halacha and the pragmatic world of halachic authorities focus on the conduct of the shote. We diagnose based on actions that we see, specifically where the actions demonstrate, as I said, irrationality. If you take a look at source number 5, an example found in the Rambam in his Mora Nevuchim, his Guide of the Perplexed, which is not itself a work of Jewish law, but what he says there is very useful. He's describing different types of actions, and he says, the deed that is empty, what kind of a deed is empty, is the deed for which no plan can be discerned. You can't understand why the person does what he's doing. Like the way some people's hands become busy when they're thinking, where there's no reason for them to be doing what they're doing and the way they're doing it. But just that's it's what their hands do when there's no thought behind it. And like the deeds of the Meshuga'im and the confused. Meshuga, I chose not to translate, but basically what it refers to is somebody who is irrational. That's what we're talking about. People who are confused. Now, I say somebody who is irrational or whose actions betray irrationality. But that isn't quite accurate. Sometimes you will have someone whose perception of reality is out of touch with reality. However, what they do on that basis is entirely logical. In other words, we're talking about somebody who is irrational, and again, we haven't really gone into definitions and examples of irrationality that's coming next. But usually, when you think of someone being irrational, what you mean is, they perceive the world as it is, and the things they do don't make sense in light of that perception of reality. So, they're walking down the street, and somebody hands them money. And they take the money and they throw it down the sewer drain. Not because they hate the person who gave it to them. Not because they have some reason they want to you know, whatever, support somebody who is living down there or whatever it is. But with no discernible reason, they throw the money down the sewer drain. So that's an example of irrational conduct. However, sometimes you have somebody who perceives the universe in such a way that doing what they're doing makes perfect sense. It's just that their perception of the world is out of touch with reality. So, for example, let's say they believe that the alligators that live in the sewer use money in order to get food. And they're throwing it down the drain because they want to support the alligators that live down there. So in terms of their perception of the world, it's way off. But if you accept their perception, then it makes perfect sense. Who wouldn't want to support the alligators? So if you take a look at source number 6, Rabbi Yonatan Rosenzweig, I mentioned him last time in the eating disorders session, in his book on, called Nafshi B'Sheilati, he says, I'm just using my English translations, but you can see the original Hebrew, source number 6, he says, even though we emphasized above that, quote, the manner of shtut, right, the act of eshota, the type, the style of eshota, is that one acts without reason or purpose, that isn't accurate for the psychotic patient. Many times, a psychotic patient acts with a certain logic based on the picture of reality that he perceives. But since we know with certainty or near certainty that his picture of reality is entirely incorrect, all of his deeds are considered without reason from beginning to end. So we would consider somebody who throws their money down the sewer to be irrational. We would also consider somebody who thinks that there are alligators in the sewer that need money to be irrational. You follow? We haven't really gotten into the definition of irrationality. That's coming immediately. But the point is that irrationality is displayed via actions that are unjustified, including where they have a justification, but the justification is out of touch with reality. That's the idea. Clear so far? We're good? Questions? Comments? Okay. So, yes, Dr. Schwartz.
Yeah, so my only question is, what's the practical difference?
The practical difference in the sense of...
The guy's still throwing the money down the sewer and it doesn't make sense for whatever reason.
Right. So I might have thought that if you have a guy who is taking the latter perspective, right? He thinks that there are alligators down there. So I would have said his reality testing is off, right? He doesn't understand the world. But on the other hand, his acts, once he takes that as his, you know, assumption about the world, make perfect sense. I'll give you the analogous case. Okay. I'll give you the case in halacha, which, well, you know what? It's source number 7. I referenced it, I believe, in a different medical ethics class. It might have been in the eating disorders class. It's a case in which you have a man whose wife wants a divorce. He has decided that he is Mashiach, right? Does anyone remember this? Moshe Feinstein's case. The fellow has decided that he is Mashiach. And in his role as Mashiach, he is climbing trees and going around without clothing on. Because he has decided he is like Adam in the garden. So he's going around without clothing on and climbing trees. If you asked me, I would say he's irrational. However, it all stems from the assumption that he is Mashiach. So I would have argued that, you know, before I saw the point that Rabbi Yonatan Rosenzweig makes in source number 6, I would have assumed he is, his actions are a logical result of what he believes to be true about the world. Therefore, he is not a shote. What Rabbi Rosenzweig seems to be saying in number 6 is that it doesn't matter. He is a shote because his belief that he is Mashiach is not real, and it is so clearly off of reality. Now, I'm hedging a little bit. Because, as some of you may remember, Rabbi Feinstein decided that the fellow who thought he was Mashiach was not a Shote. He felt that this fellow is actually, you know, acting with logic, that given his understanding of the way the world is, actually is legitimate. If you look in source number 7, he says, Rabbi Feinstein says, one could argue further that also all of his foolish actions, which emerge from his error that he is Mashiach, that according to his bad thought, he is actually repairing the world, these do not render him a shoteh for all matters. One who acts according to a certain logic and path that he believes, even if it is great foolishness, is not considered a shoteh for this. Rabbi Feinstein made the remarkable argument that this man could divorce his wife. Now, you might argue that Rabbi Feinstein was bending over backward to find a way for her to be able to get divorced. Right? He didn't want her to be stuck as an aguna, and therefore he made a ruling, which is really a remarkable ruling. In, you know, in light of the sources that inform source number 6, Rabbi Rosenzweig, it would seem this man would be a shoteh. Rabbi Feinstein felt, no, this person is not a shoteh. He's wrong, but being wrong doesn't make you a shoteh. Which is true.
But that goes together with current thoughts about capacity.
Yes, it does. Yes, it does. You are absolutely correct. If you take a look at source number 8, I'll give you as an example, the Rambam in the Laws of Inheritance, Hilchos Nachlos, says something which secular law will 100% agree with. It says, when a child matures, even if he eats and drinks excessively and squanders his property and travels a bad path, the court may not keep his assets from him and may not appoint a guardian. Doing things that we think are silly or are bad for you, making bad decisions, is not the same thing as being a shoteh. There's a difference between irrationality and bad decision making. As a matter of fact, a shoteh may be very bright. Rabbi Feinstein points this out in source number 9, the Hebrew's at the bottom of one side, the English is at the top of the next side. He says, certainly there is a difference between a shoteh and one who is exceptionally unintelligent. For being a shoteh is not about powers of understanding his affairs, understanding, and not in the rational sense, but in the sense of understanding facts. Even one who is able to understand matters may have a confused, torn mind, meaning that he knows and understands that there are differences between the things he sees, but he errs in his delusions. And his delusions change in very brief periods of time. It's not about how smart you are. This is true in secular ethics, as Dr. Kirshen points out. And it's true in halacha as well. So irrational is not the same thing as ignorant. Irrational is not the same thing as poor judgment. Irrational is also not the same thing as emotional disturbance. Sometimes those two overlap, but not necessarily. If you take a look at source number 10, there's a remarkable book about shoteh called Mishpatei Hada'as. I see the note, Dr. Todd, in the chat. We're going to be coming to that. That's going to be, I think, the second vignette. If you take a look at source number 10, this is my translation of Rabbi Moshe Farbstein's Mishpatei Hada'as. He says, the concept of shoteh is not identical to, quote, mentally ill. I should note, I'm just going to throw this in here because I think it should be mentioned somewhere. The term in Hebrew for mental illness is machalat ha-nefesh, right? Mentally ill is chole nefesh. That doesn't really translate to mentally ill. It's more emotionally ill. But because the term that's used in English so often is mental illness, that's what I'm going to use. It's the more popular term. You write emotional illness and people get confused. But note that much of what we call mental illness is not really mental at all. So he writes, the concept of shoteh is not identical to mentally ill. A shoteh is anyone whose mind is confused and his thought processes or actions are impaired. The confusion can come from various causes. Mental illness can cause it. A, quote, bad spirit, by which he means depression generally. Brain injury, diseases of age, right, dementia, or any reason. And there is no halachic difference between them. What matters is the result, not the pathology behind it. Halacha that deals with the shoteh mostly does not deal with the cause of the shtut, but its results. For example, one who is struck by depression is not called a shoteh unless the illness causes confusion in his thoughts or behavior. So, you know, being irrational is not the same as being mentally ill, although mental illness can cause irrationality. But fundamentally, irrationality is expressed as the inability to distinguish reality from fantasy. That's what we're talking about. If you take a look at source number 11, this is from Dr. Strauss again. The most common usage of the word, meaning shoteh, has been reserved for and most closely describes the clinical phenomenon of psychosis, the state in which an individual lacks the ability to distinguish reality from fantasy. With gross impairment of reality testing and insight, the psychotic individual will incorrectly evaluate perceptions and thoughts, and in so doing make incorrect inferences about external reality despite evidence to the contrary. This state is frequently associated with a severe impairment of social and personal functioning, characterized by an inability to perform expected roles. They can't manage their affairs. They can't get along in society. Hang on one second. While the concept of shoteh is associated with psychosis, a more precise description of its phenomenology and its application to contemporary clinical medicine remains unclear. It's hard to come up with a one word in English that is truly analogous to shoteh. The best that I have is insane, which again is a legal term, not a medical term. Irrational is another attempt, but it's not really a great word for it. So what we're seeing, and I'm just going to conclude this section with one more thought, and then I'll take questions and comments. What we're seeing here is somebody who is out of touch with reality, such that the decisions that they make don't comport with real world, what we observe. Or they see reality, however, their reaction to reality is irrational. That's really what we're talking about. And we're assessing their actions as opposed to the state that drives the actions. Examples of situations, to use modern clinical terminology, Dr. Strauss favors these examples. Acute schizophrenic psychotic state, mood disorders that involve psychotic behaviors, and sometimes neuroses that lead to behavior that's out of touch with reality. In source number 12, I brought you from Rabbi Yoni Rosenzweig, the Gemara also presents for us symptoms of shtut, the case of being a shoteh, for those whose patients are not psychotic but neurotic. Their view of reality is not damaged in a fundamental, their view of reality is not damaged in a fundamental, comprehensive way, but they are shotim exclusively in a certain area. And that's a term I want to come back to. Somebody who is a localized shoteh. One last sentence, and then I'm going to take questions and comments. And that is, the shoteh is not the only case of somebody who lacks competence in Jewish law. So another example, which the Rambam mentions, is the peti. Peti is somebody with an intellectual disability such that they have very poor comprehension. The Rambam also mentions somebody who is nechpaz. Nechpaz is somebody who is hasty, such that they don't use a rational thought process because they rush to their conclusion. So these categories and others can come up. They don't qualify as a shoteh. Nonetheless, they may still lack capacity. They're just beyond the scope of what we're going to be able to get to this evening. Okay, questions and comments. Yes, Dr. Libman.
If someone has a very narrow area where they seem to have like a conspiracy that vaccinations are there to poison us and they have these microchips in there, but they otherwise may function as accountants or some other legitimate job, but they have bought into a conspiracy, or the people who think the world is flat and all the astronauts have been paid to lie about it, but they also seem rather intact in other right. dimensions. So who are they? How do they get classified?
Right. So that's going to be our first vignette, is going to be exactly that question. What we call in Hebrew, shotela davar echad. Somebody who is a shotet in one particular area, and in all other areas, they seem to interact just fine. Right? They think the world is flat. However, they're also brilliant investors. You know, are you going to tell me they can't trade stocks because they believe the world is flat? So they, so we're going to need to talk about that. It's an excellent question. Other questions and comments?
Can you think about anyone in the Bible that you can say that he was a shofet?
So the argument is often made that the depression, or ruach ra'ah, depending on which term you prefer to use, that Shaul experiences, reaches that threshold. Abarbanel, makes that push. He makes that suggestion. So that's sort of the classic example that is brought. There are other cases that you can bring, but because Abarbanel says that in the case of Shaul, like, I find it very difficult to say that. But because he said it, I mentioned it in response to your question. Dr. Libman, the other Dr. Libman. No? I don't hear you. Don't know. Okay. We can come back to you. All right. So before we can get to the vignettes, we need to see a key passage of Gemara, which is going to drive a lot of what we discuss. Because there's a question. Before we can get to the discussion about somebody who is a shoteh in a particular arena, or a person who is a shoteh just some of the time, like Dr. Todd wrote in the chat, we need to ask, what about somebody whose actions could be explained as rational or irrational? I can't tell. I don't know. They're doing things which a shoteh might do. However, they might not actually be a shoteh. There could be some other reason for what they're doing. So how do we assess in a situation like that? So this is the classic Gemara in Chagiga, in source number 13. The Gemara asks, it's quoting a Brisa first, who is a shoteh? No hands, okay? Who is a shoteh? And it gives you three symptoms. One who travels alone at night, one who sleeps in a cemetery, one who tears his clothing. Now, there's a lot of commentary on each of the symptoms we've just mentioned. First of all, one who travels alone at night. So the commentators on that stress that it's specifically where traveling alone at night poses a threat to the person's safety. If you live in a city where people walk around at night, and especially in our day, you have electric lights, it's a reasonably safe area. Traveling alone at night does not make you a shoteh, no matter what your mother says. So the issue is it has to be what reasonable people would call a dangerous situation. Rabbi Yitzchak Zilberstein in Shiurei Torah Lerofim says, for a contemporary example, somebody who walks into heavy traffic without looking. Somebody who would walk into an enemy city. Remember, Rabbi Zilberstein is in Israel. So you have a Jewish person who wanders into a city that's hostile to Jews. So that would qualify as this sort of shoteh situation. The Tshuvas Chazon Yechezkel quotes Rav Chaim Soloveitchik saying that it could be caused by somebody who's experiencing depression with a psychotic nature. So it's not just the depression, but that it's causing psychotic behavior. In terms of sleeping in the cemetery, so Rabbi Yitzchak Zilberstein says as a contemporary example, someone who refuses to talk to people, refuses to see his children and grandchildren, and stops eating. They're acting like they're already dead. The person who tears their clothing. So Rabbi Zilberstein says the equivalent is somebody who refuses to take a haircut and to shave, walks around in public smelling terrible. That kind of antisocial behavior. That's what we're talking about. So that's your opening line. You have three symptoms that are given. But then you have a debate. Do you have to do all three? Or does doing just one of them qualify a person as a shote? Debate between Rav Huna and Rabbi Yochanan. Rav Huna said, one who displays all of these at once, you got to do all three in order to qualify as a shote. Rabbi Yochanan said, no, even one of these behaviors qualifies the person as a shote. But then the Gemara says, not so fast. The debate is not what it sounds like. But what is the case? If he acts apparently irrationally, even one should suffice. I don't understand why you need all three if I can see from one behavior that this person is, in fact, irrational. One symptom should do it. If he does not act irrationally, even all of the symptoms would not suffice. Why are you telling me that he needs to have, either that one is enough or that all three work? Either he's acting like he's irrational or he's not acting like he's irrational. What's the difference, one symptom or three symptoms? So the Gemara explains, no, this is where he acts apparently irrationally, but you could explain away each of the behaviors. Regarding sleeping in the cemetery, perhaps he did it to receive an impure spirit. Speaking in a generation when there is a common belief that by sleeping in the cemetery, you can connect with impure forces. Granted that in a different generation, people would say that belief itself is irrational. But if you're living at a time where that is a normal belief, we may think that sleeping in the cemetery is a bad idea and connecting with impure forces is a bad idea. But it's not actually irrational. Regarding travel alone at night, perhaps he was gripped by gandripos. There's a lot of debate as to what exactly gandripos is. Rashi brings you the possibility that it refers to anxiety that's causing him to wander around alone at night. Alternatively, he says it may be physiological. The person is overheating, and that causes them to want to wander around alone at night. Rabbi Nassan of Rome, Rabbi Nassan Bal Ha'aruch, offers other explanations. But the point is a state in which he's not irrational. Regarding tearing his clothing, maybe he's lost in thought. The Gemara says, Baal Machshavot, he has a lot of thoughts. Rabbi J. David Bleich, in an article in his Contemporary Halachic Problem, says, yeah, maybe he's lost in thought. So once a person performs all of these behaviors, I stop giving explanations for his conduct. Right? If you do one of these, so, all right, maybe he's lost in thought. Maybe he was anxious. Maybe he thought sleeping in the cemetery was actually a helpful thing for him. But you do all three. Three strikes and you're out. Once he performs all of them, it's like an animal that gores an ox, a donkey, and a camel. It is now identified as dangerous for all. The same thing is true regarding this person. So what we've said is, where a person acts in a way that demonstrates irrationality using the symptoms that we have here right now. We have to talk about other symptoms, but right now we're using the symptoms in the Gemara. So when a person acts in a way that demonstrates irrationality, and we know he's doing it irrationally, even one of these suffices. But on the other hand, if I don't know, then Rav Huna says you need to do all three. Rabbi Yochanan says no. Even one is sufficient to label this person a shote. One more line in the Gemara. Rav Papa said, you know, we have a different source, and I think Rav Huna wasn't familiar with it. Had Rav Huna heard the following lesson, who is a shote? One who destroys that which people give him. Whatever you give him for property, he destroys it. And there's some debate as to whether that means aggressively destructive or simply that he abandons it without planning to return for it. That's unclear. But if he had heard that, he would have recanted. He would have said, yeah, even one of those is already sufficient. To which the Gemara asks, top of the next page, does that mean he would have recanted from the trait of tearing his clothing because it's similar? Or he would have recanted from all of them, meaning none of those matter, just this trait matters? Teiku, we don't know. That remains unclarified. So what emerges from the Gemara is, if one's actions could be explained as being irrational or as being rational, Rav Huna said you need all three behaviors. Rabbi Yochanan said even one is sufficient. Don't go for the alternative explanations for what they did. And Rav Papa might think that Rav Huna believes that destroying one's property stands on its own as an act which cannot be explained away. Clear? Are we good? That's the hardest part of what we need to discuss, is getting that Gemara straight. Everything else after that is comparatively easy, which is why I gave you a summary in source number 14. So you could see just bullet points from the Gemara. Rav Huna said, Shota diagnosis requires all three actions if they could be explained as rational. Rabbi Yochanan thinks one such act is enough. Rav Papa thinks, or may think, that Rav Huna says that tearing clothing or destroying one's property stands on its own as an act which cannot be explained away and in and of itself is sufficient. We haven't said yet who we follow in halacha. We'll get to that. But that's the key passage regarding behavior that could be read one way or another way. Questions and comments on that Gemara? Yes, Dr. Libman.
I think it's sort of strange to look at behavior that actually could have other very reasonable explanations. I don't think you could look at an action out of context. So doctors may travel through house calls at night. That has nothing to do with them being irrational. Someone may actually find some spiritual connection to their sibling who is lying in the cemetery, and they want to be near the Batseva, and they find some connection, and they just want to lie there for that reason. They may feel they don't want to be robbed, so they rip some of their clothes, so they're lying there, so they look a little poor, so then someone will not rob them because they actually do have funds and money. So when you look at all three, all of them might in fact be rational. So I think you need to actually analyze, is this person irrational or not? But to give examples, I think examples which could in fact be explained away in a different way is kind of hazardous, because then you may apply a definition of irrationality to a person who may be quite rational.
Yep. So we're going to have to come back to your point. You are 100% correct. We seem to be dealing with a case in which we don't have the option of assessing in any, or not assessing, of following up. So now I just need to know what's the deal with this person. And Rav Huna is saying, I'm willing to do this with one symptom and two symptoms, but if I'm seeing all three, I have to draw the line. Rabbi Yochanan is saying, nope, not interested in his justifications. This person is a shota, next patient. We're going to come back to this because there's a lot more to be said. I have not given you yet the halachic material on it, which is going to qualify a lot of what we're saying. I will already, just to set your mind at ease, tell you that we're going to say that even Rabbi Yochanan believes, even Rabbi Yochanan, who is the most expansive in his definition of shota, believes that the person has to be what's called muchzak. They have to be somebody who does this repeatedly. Not just that they went one night and went out to the cemetery or walked around alone or whatever it was, but that they do this as perpetual behavior. So that's already a key piece of it, which we haven't seen from the Gemara, but we're going to see more along those lines.
Well, I know somebody that survived the Holocaust because she lied down among dead people.
Right. And that's an entirely unique situation. That's not one that you could, you're right. That they would not be labeled a shotef for that. Right. So one of the questions that you have to ask when you read this, and I alluded to it before, is the question of actions that are not on the list in the Gemara in Chagiga. What do you do with actions that are not on the list that we would identify as shota behaviors? So, Rabbeinu Avigdor was a rabbi in early Ashkenaz, and he was quoted by Rabbi Yosef Kolon in regards to a get and the question of whether the husband was or was not a shoteh. And look at what Rabbi Kolon brings from Rabbeinu Avigdor. He says in number 15, the husband's mind was torn, indicating confusion. And they checked him threefold. They checked him three times. It was clear to them that he was healthy at that time when he gave the get. And regarding this, I humbly responded that if he was not established as a shoteh with the symptoms listed in Chagiga, he is as a sane person for all of his affairs and no test is needed. Rabbeinu Avigdor said, the only way to become a shoteh is by doing the things that the Gemara in Chagiga listed. That Gemara began with a statement, who is a shoteh? Only if you do these things. And that was a popular position among Ashkenazi authorities in the 13th, 14th, 15th centuries. The Mordechai was of that position. Rabbeinu Simcha was of that position. On the other hand, the Rambam disagrees. The Rambam we'll have to see in a little bit. But if you take a look at source number 16, Rabbi Dr. Avram Steinberg says, one who acts clearly as a full shoteh, he acts as a mishuga before our eyes. His status is that of a shoteh for all matters, even if he doesn't have any of the symptoms listed by our sages. Don't get hung up on this list. These are examples. They are not the full list of shoteh behaviors. Now, I should say, there's a ton of rabbinic commentary and debate on this Gemara. Questions about whether, excuse me, only actions make someone a shoteh, but speech might not. There's a lot, but I'm trying to stay focused because I want to make sure that we have practical elements and not spend the entire time analyzing this Gemara. So we're going to come back to this Gemara. I'm putting this Gemara on hold right now, understanding we need to know more. Just to add two other notes. We already said in the very beginning from Dr. Strauss that the shoteh is going to be evaluated by the rabbi, by the Beit Din, using medical expertise. I wanted to just show you Rabbi Dr. Moshe Halevi Spiro in source number 17 in Israel. In his Handbook of Psychotherapy and Jewish Ethics, says the following. The question of reliable determination of incompetence directly concerns our discussions. The Talmud and Code speak of certain diagnostic tests, or bidikot. Rorschach himself would have termed this a, I don't know if he's writing Versuch, I don't know, I don't have any German to work with. An experiment, which are designed to determine mental competence in matrilegal matters. What he's talking about is where the Gemara talks about somebody who can't speak, and now we need to determine whether they are competent to divorce or to marry. So he says, for example, when there is cause to doubt an individual's sanity and hence legal competence to issue a writ of divorce, the codes note that one might query the individual on topics of common knowledge. If it is winter, one asks the person if he wishes to glean fruits known to grow only in the summer. If it is summer, we ask whether the individual wishes to harvest fruits known to grow only in the winter. As Rabbi Yechiel Michal Epstein and others add, one may employ any tone of question which will require use of fundamental psychological abilities that underwrite mental competence. I don't think the word was tone. I have loan here, but I retyped this and I probably just have a typo. Any something of question in that previous line. These abilities would seem to be judgment, orientation in time and space, attention, reality testing, and so forth. Finally, while the choice of examination is left to the discretion of the Dayan, the judge, reliability demands that at least three demonstrations be given of the abilities or disabilities in question. But he's willing to say, line of question. Thank you, Dr. Todd. Yes, line of question is what it would have been in the original. Thanks for the correction. So, we would be willing, according to this, to work with contemporary tests. Rabbi Dr. Avram Steinberg, in source number 18, puts it succinctly. He says, in our day, halachic authorities have accepted that anyone whom the doctors, who are expert in mental illnesses, establish as suffering perpetually from a severe and defined mental illness, and he lacks any ability to assess intellectually and make rational judgment, he is a full shoteh for all matters. That's the rule. So it's going to be for a medical assessment, which is going to inform the decision of the judge slash the rabbi. One last point, and then I'm going to take questions before we move on to the vignettes and the practical issues of the Gemara and Chagiga. How does somebody lose shoteh status? We're spending a lot of time on how somebody becomes a shoteh. How do you become an unshoteh? So two different approaches. One, the symptoms stop. The assumption is that it ends once the symptoms stop. Rabbi Yitzchak Shmelkis, the Beis Yitzchak, in source number 19, quotes his grandfather, halachic authority known as the Tvuos Shor, who said that even one act qualifies him as a shoteh. It is also true that the status is uprooted via one act. He just has to stop acting like a shoteh, just once. But in any case, it is required that there be evidence that he is healed. At all times, the shoteh tears his clothing. If he doesn't tear it one day, we know he is healed. So just stop doing whatever the shoteh action is, and that's fine. The Tzemach Tzedek, the second Lubavitcher Rebbe, took the same position, and it's an assessment that has to be made based on seeing his behavior. That's one approach. The other approach is that the treatment is successful. So as an example, we're going to come back in vignette 2 to talk about somebody who is sometimes shoteh and sometimes not. But take a look at the comment from Rabbi Dr. Steinberg in source number 20, Hebrews to the bottom of one side, English to the top of the next side. He says, a shoteh who received therapeutic medicine, and because of the influence of the medicine he functions normally, is considered healthy at times, for all matters. And the rule is then that when he is acting in a healthy way, he's healthy. He's taking his medication. He's acting rationally. He's not a shoteh during that time. Reb Farbstein, in source number 21, says, it appears that one should clarify the entire debate of the halachic authorities and the problems of establishing the health of the shoteh for a particular matter are only when the reason to establish that he is healthy is only that we have not seen him perform an act of shtut. He says there will be debate if your evidence that he's not a shoteh is just that you saw him not act like a shoteh. But there could be another means of clarification. If he is healed from the illness, meaning the cause for the deeds of shtut is gone, there is no doubt that such a person will be ruled healthy. For example, one who suffers from baseless fear, and because of that he establishes a pattern of deeds of shtut, it is possible that even if he stops performing the shtut for some time, he still will be ruled a shoteh, as we have clarified. But if he is assessed and it is clarified that his fear has left him, it is clear that he will be ruled healthy. If the underlying cause is gone, even though we've said that we diagnose a shoteh based on actions and not based on the pathology, nonetheless, if we know the pathology that's leading to the actions and the pathology is successfully treated, the person stops being labeled a shoteh. So just to make sure that we know what we've said in the last, almost an hour. It's about actions, not pathology, number one. It's about irrational perception of reality or thought process, not about bad decision making. It's about behavior, and when you're dealing with behavior which could be interpreted as shoteh behavior, or otherwise, we have a debate in the Gemara we need to come back to. One loses shoteh status by demonstrating health or where the underlying cause is identified and healed. I see that there were some notes in the chat. I'm going to just try to read those quickly and see if there's anything for me to address. The inebriation or being drugged would have to be ruled out as an explanation. That is definitely true. There is some discussion about that because he's also considered unable, unqualified or incapacitated when drugged. But it won't affect the person when their drugging is over. Rav Steinberg used the term suffering perpetually. Does this exclude temporary states of irrationality as previously mentioned? The answer is no. We're going to come back to that in a little bit. Someone could have a phobia and act completely irrationally at the sight of a spider, for instance, but be totally normal otherwise. We're getting to that. That's going to be the vignette number one, the localized shoteh. So we're going to be talking about that as well. There's just so much that you have to do in order to get anywhere in this topic. So we're doing a lot of baseline stuff. Next note in the chat. If a person says, I still have the hallucinations, but I know they are irrational and I don't act on them. That's a really interesting question. It sounds to me like if they are reliably able to not act on them, then they're not a shoted. That would be my gut based on what I've learned and what I've seen. But it's a very interesting question. I think that's the answer, but I'm not 100% sure. Yeah, good question. Okay. Other questions and comments? People can speak out loud. You don't have to write it in the chat. Someone told me in the last session I didn't allow enough time for discussion, so I want to make sure that I'm giving everybody the full opportunity to discuss.
I have a question.
Yes, Susan.
There's one thing that hasn't come up at all, and I'm wondering if it will or if it fits in here anywhere. There's been no mention about the irrational behavior that is violent.
So there has been a little bit of an indication for it. We talked about the person who is not able to function properly within their role in society because of their perception of reality. But you're right. The Jewish sources that we talked about didn't mention violence per se. There is discussion in halachic sources. It was the Rush, Rabbeinu Usher, end of the 13th century, beginning of the 14th, who dealt with a case of a woman who wanted to have a get. And she said her husband gets very angry. There was no mention specifically of violence, although the fear of it seemed, you know, palpable in the responsum. And she said she's worried because he's getting worse, and she wants the get before he reaches a stage where he won't be qualified anymore to give the get. He'll be considered a shote. And Rabbeinu Asher's answer, in part, was to say, even if he is out of control with his anger, that in and of itself will not cause him to be labeled a shote. He'll still be qualified to give a get. That's not the full answer that he gives, but that's the part that's, you know, germane for our discussion. In general, we find when you're dealing with cases of get, and this goes back to Rabbi Feinstein and the fellow who thought he was Mashiach, halachic authorities tend to try to avoid labeling somebody a shote, such that the wife is now going to be ineligible for a divorce. They really try to avoid that. One of the major, major classic cases, which spawned a lot of the halachic discussion in this area, was a get in a city, the name of which is written in English as C-L-E-V-E-S. And I always worry that I'm mispronouncing it. I assumed it was Cleves, but I don't actually know. Involving a man and woman, young man and woman who got married, and then the husband decided that people were out to attack him and he ran away, and in the end he gives a get, and then the get is challenged because there's a claim that he was a shote at the time, and it becomes this massive cause celeb, and every rabbi in Europe at the time writes on this topic. Either that he is a shote or that he's not a shote. And a lot of the literature we have on this question stems directly from that case. As a general principle, you don't want a woman to be stranded by labeling somebody a shote. On the other hand, if you incorrectly say he's not a shote and he's able to divorce, then you're taking a woman who is halachically a married woman and calling her single. That's not a good solution either. So this becomes a very, very difficult area in halacha. Okay, so let's get to our vignettes. The first vignette addresses a lot of the questions that we've asked and is going to take us back to the Gemara in Chagiga. If you turn back to the first side of the source sheet, vignette number one. Janet, age 17, is clinically diagnosed as severely anorexic and is being treated in an inpatient facility. Her body image is clearly irrational. Does Janet qualify as a shote, such that she is exempt from halachic obligations? I added in brackets, of course, Janet may also be exempt from any halachic obligations which interfere with her life-saving treatment. But our question is more broad about halachic obligations in general. In other words, you have somebody, like we said in our eating disorders session, you have somebody who's dealing with severe anorexia, you do what you need to do in order to be able to heal them. But that's not my question. My question is she in fact considered a shotam? Because in her mind, she is obese. Even though to anybody looking at her, it is far from it, and she's in fact dangerously ill. So what are we going to say in a situation like that? Is she a shota? What would you say? How would you address this? No one wants to take this on.
Wouldn't this be the case though? She's a shota in terms of her body image, but in terms of other normal functions, she's not?
So that's the question. That's exactly the question. What do we say? With her body image, for sure, when it comes to eating issues, she is a shota. That I can agree with. She is the equivalent of somebody who destroys their property. She is destroying her body because she doesn't perceive it accurately. The question will now be, what about her other areas of functioning? Can she trade stocks? Is that an option? So here we go back to our Gemara in Chagiga. Because that's our starting point. What happens when you have somebody who is engaging in one particular behavior for which we believe they are irrational? However, it's only one behavior. So we have three different views as to whether we follow Rav Huna, who said you need all three behaviors, or whether we follow Rabbi Yochanan. It's not quite the same because here we're not asking how do I interpret her actions. Without a doubt, when it comes to this issue, she is a shota. Nonetheless, we go back to this Gemara and the question of three or one. So the first view that we'll bring is the most minimal view for what a shota is. And that says you need all three symptoms. Rabbi Meir of Rotenberg, Maram Rotenberg, quoted Rabbeinu Simcha of Speyer in Germany in source number 22. Rabbeinu Simcha of Speyer, he's one of the authors of the Tosfot, wrote that we do not assume someone is a shote vis-a-vis divorce until we see the symptoms of shtut listed in Chagiga. You need three symptoms, and not only that, you need all three symptoms that are there in the Gemara specifically, like the straight read of Rav Huna. That's one view. It's hard to be a shota. Intermediate view. Rabbi Menachem Meiri. He argues in 13th century France, source number 23. Anyone who is presumed to be a shota, and we see that he does something in the manner of shtut, that is a clear symptom, in the manner of shtut, something that is a clear symptom for him. Tearing his clothing in the manner of shtut, or destroying what is given to him. That's somebody who is presumed to be a shota. But sleeping in the cemetery and going out alone at night are not clear symptoms. And even if one does them in the manner of shtut, for going out alone could be because this gandripos grips him. So he says it depends on what you're doing. He sounds a little bit like Rav Papa. He says, if you're destroying property, like tearing clothing, you're a shota. For everything, it appears. The other symptoms are not so clear-cut, and then you need to have three of them. Your first view, the narrowest view, says only with the three symptoms that are there in the Gemara. Your second view, your intermediate view, says if you're destroying things, shota for everything automatically. And then you have the Rambam. And the Rambam is the most expansive view. The Rambam is in source number 24. He says, a shote is biblically disqualified from testimony, for he is not obligated in mitzvot. Rambam doesn't say it's because he has no understanding of reality. He says it's because he's not obligated in mitzvot. I'm not going to that discussion right now. It's a fascinating discussion as to why he uses that term, but it's not relevant for us tonight. He says this is not only a shote who walks around without clothing on, who breaks implements and throws stones, but anyone whose mind is confused, such that his mind is always mixed up on a matter, right? This is the phrase that we saw used before. I think I translated before as perpetually. It's the same thing. Tamid. Even if he can converse normally on other matters, he is disqualified and is considered in the class of Shote. The Rambam says, I'm not even giving you the Gemara's symptoms. Some of his symptoms overlap with the Gemara's symptoms. But you notice he didn't talk about sleeping in the cemetery, right? He didn't talk about walking around alone at night. He did talk about breaking things. He did talk about throwing stones. It's close, but the Rambam says it isn't about that. As long as the person is perpetually confused on some matter, even if he can converse on other matters, this person is a shote. That is clearly the broadest definition of shote that we have seen. You see the three different views? Either just the Gemara's list, or just the Gemara's list, or being destructive, or anything goes as long as they are perpetually a shote on a particular matter. So we're going to end up following the Rambam on this. So we need to have a better understanding of the Rambam's position. Rav Yosef Karo, the Beis Yosef, explained, I brought it in source number 25, that the Rambam is moved to this position because the Gemara in Chagiga is not our only source. We also have a Tosefta, a source contemporary to the Mishnah. We also have a passage in the Jerusalem Talmud, in the Yerushalmi. And the lists in each of those sources do not quite match. There's overlap, but they don't quite match. So Rabbi Yosef Karo says in source number 25, it would appear that one of the four behaviors mentioned in the Talmud, right? Sleeping in the cemetery, going out alone at night, destroying what is given to them, tearing their clothing, would render a person a shote. But performing other irrational acts will leave a person in his presumed status of sanity. That's what I would have thought. But from the Rambam, who did not mention these acts and only said one whose mind is torn in some matter, it sounds as though the four items taught here are not specific and are only examples, and other behaviors could also do it. It appears that he was driven to state thus from the fact that the former source, the Gemara's initial source, listed three behaviors, did not list destroys that which people give him. And the latter source listed destroys that which people give him, did not mention the other three. So the Rambam says, it's not about a particular list at all. Why did the Rambam omit the Gemara's examples? Rav Nachum Rabinovich in his Yad Pshuta says, because they're just examples. Diana writes in the chat, in that case, the best way to determine that is through the diagnostic tests or questions. It's almost as though you are a descendant of the Chasam Sofer. If you take a look at source number 26, Rav Moshe Sofer says, judging in the matter of Shotim is impossible other than through the eyes of a judge who understands his nature. One cannot clarify his nature in writing. As the Rambam wrote, the judge only has what his eyes see. In each individual case, you are going to need to test and assess based on the case at hand. It's not about a formal list. That's the position of the Rambam. And so the Rambam is willing to call somebody a Shote, even if they don't fit the narrow cases that we've seen. Now, we need to understand more here. There are four possible limitations that are suggested about the Rambam's expansive view of the Shote. The first one is the one I mentioned before. The Beis Yosef suggests it. Rabbi Chiyo Michal Epstein in the Aruch HaShulchan brings it. The person has to be muchzak. It has to be a pattern. Like the Rambam said, tamid or bitmidud, it has to be perpetual. Take a look at number 27. This is a very important source. He's basing himself on a comment in Tosfos as well as in the Rambam's language. He says, acting in an irrational manner is when one does this many times. But doing it once or twice does not cause us to consider him a shote for this. And the Rambam believed that the Talmud's list is not specific. The same applies if we see someone whose mind is perpetually confused on some matter, doing something which those who are whole in their minds would not do. Such a person is considered a shote. And there are great authorities who believe that shote is only that which is stated in the Talmud as we have written, but their position has been rejected by all of the authorities. The Torah also agreed with the Rambam. And it appears to me that even these great authorities, the ones who like the Gemara's list, agree with the Rambam. They just believe that since this person is not a shote in other areas, it's hard for us to establish whether he is performing this action in an irrational manner or not. So they are, you know, they want the list of symptoms. But the Rambam says no. That's number one. So the Rambam is only saying this if there is an established pattern of such conduct. That's number one. Number two, I'm going to pause for a second just to remind people to sign in the chat if you want CME credit and you haven't signed in yet. Number two, some say that the Rambam will only apply this if the person is practicing what is called shtus gadol, in the event that what they're doing is really visibly irrational, not borderline. It's got to be clear cut. In source number 28, Rav Menachem Mendel Schneerson, not the last Lubavitcher Rebbe, but the second one, the Tzemach Tzedek. He says, some say that even according to the Rambam, who thinks that the symptoms in Chagiga are not specific, still, Marik wrote this is only if one has reached great shtut like these. It has to be clear cut. That's number two. Number three, some argue the Rambam's expansion only applies for laws of testimony. Because that's where the Rambam brought his definition. Even though the laws of the Shoteh show up in all sorts of places in the Rambam's Mishneh Torah, nonetheless, he only defined it in the laws of testimony. So maybe it's only about that. Other authorities disagree. I'm not going into it in great length, but if you take a look at source number 29, Rav Nachum Rabinovich points out that the Rambam's source for the rules of Shoteh comes from a Tosefta that deals with testimony, and he suggests that that's why the Rambam did so. Some also dispute whether the Rambam meant Shoteh L'davar Echad is disqualified from all mitzvot or not. But I'm not going to go there because I'm looking at the time and we've got to move on beyond that. It's too bad. It's an interesting issue. The bottom line out of this segment is, in practice we follow the Rambam, but halachic authorities try to limit his application. There's a lot of fear about over-applying this and rendering people a Shoteh when they are not. There are lots of reasons why people do irrational things, and it isn't necessarily that they are a shoteh. If you take a look at source number 30, Rabbi Yonatan Rosenzweig, he says, because many sane people have strange ways or unusual personality traits, yet they do not have the status of shotim. One must be careful of applying this category of shoteh for one matter other than in clear-cut cases. And adding to that, the Rambam may only mean it in cases where it's shtut gadol, where it's of a significant act of shtut. So, not to mention, not everybody agrees with the Rambam. So, because of this, what we say is the following: in the event that somebody acts in a particular way that isn't necessarily on the Gemara's list, that is irrational, and they do it perpetually in a way that's clear cut, then we are willing to say this person is in fact a shoteh, not only on this one area, but in general. The person is in fact considered to be a shoteh. Whereas, if the person is seen to be rational in all other areas, then we limit the shtut just to this one narrow area. Finally, in the event that we have explanations for why the person does what they're doing, Dr. Libman suggested before, you had, you know, somebody who had reasons to do all three items on the list in the Gemara and Chagiga. We prefer, writes Rabbi Yechezkel Roth, the Chazon Yechezkel, we prefer an explanation which is klali, not situational, which will cover all the cases that come up, as opposed to, he did this because this, he did this because that, he did this because of the third thing. We want an explanation that will sum up everything and catch everything together. Take a look on your sheet. Source number 31, Rabbi Dr. Avram Steinberg. One whose mind is torn and confused perpetually on one matter, but in all other areas he acts in a sane way, he is a shoteh for one matter. and all mitzvot connected to that matter are not binding for him. But for other areas, he is not considered a shota. If he's demonstrably rational in all other ways, we don't treat him as a shota. And Rabbi Roth, major posek for the Satmar community in the U.S. for many years, says we must link a perpetual manifestation with a single ongoing cause if we want to explain it away. So going back to our case, the case of Janet, the 17-year-old girl with severe anorexia, you could well say this is a shota ledavar echad, a shota in one area, the area of body image. You could argue that since they are seen to be rational in other areas, they're a shota only for eating issues. However, their eating issues may spill over to all other areas of their lives, because anorexia is not necessarily limited to how they eat. It may affect exercise, it may affect all sorts of interactions. So take a look at source number 33, Rabbi Yonatan Rosenzweig. He says, one should note that there are cases in which those who suffer from anorexia are included in the category of complete shota, when their entire lives revolve only around this one issue. Even though the area of the shtut is focused on the subject of eating, since the area of eating is so central to a person's life, those who deal with anorexia can sometimes reach the point where all of their energies are devoted exclusively to this particular area. And so one should establish that their shtut is complete and total. That can really happen. Someone sent me a message in the chat asking me how I would classify OCD. It's a very good question. It really depends on how, number one, severe it is in terms of the compulsions, and number two, how broad it is. That will determine, you know, how far we go in terms of applying the label of shota. I want to at least get to vignette number two. It's 852. Case number two is one that people ask about a lot as well. The case that I gave you there, Sydney, age 88, is dealing with moderate dementia. At times, he is relatively lucid, but there are episodes during which he seems to think he is 60 years younger and interacting with his family and friends from that period. Is Sydney a shota during his periods of lucidity? When he is thinking he's interacting with people from 60 years ago, his actions are clearly out of touch with reality. But what about when he is fully understanding the world that he lives in? This is what we call, in the Gemara's terminology, itim chalim itim shota. Sometimes he's healthy, and sometimes he's not. Source number 34, the Gemara in Rosh Hashanah. If one is sometimes healthy and sometimes shota, when he is healthy, he is as one who is sane for all matters. When he is a shota for all matters. It all depends on his state right now. Now, this is different from the case of the shota ledavar echad, who was considered a shota for everything where I didn't know them to be healthy in general areas, right? The difference is because somebody who is always irrational in a particular situation, whenever this situation comes up, that person is a shota. That's a shota ledavar echad. They're only a shota in that narrow area. However, somebody who at times is a shota for everything, and at times is a shota for nothing, is itim chalim itim shota. Sometimes they're a shota, and sometimes they are not. And the rule in such a case is what the Gemara tells you in source 34. It's also found in the Tosefta in source number 35. The rule is, that person, when they are lucid, is not a shota, is obligated in mitzvot, is able to divorce the whole bit. To which we have a question. How do I know what the person is at any given moment? Right? They gave the get, and then somebody challenges it and says, well, I think they were a shota when they gave the get. Now what do we do? So this comes up. It's a Gemara in Yevamos, Daf Kuf Yud Gimel. How do I know his status? So the answer is, in the event that I don't know the person's status, I don't know what happened at that moment, the rule is that in the event that the periods when they are healthy and the periods when they are unhealthy are basically 50-50, then we have to be strict and assume they were Ashota when, you know, in the moment in question. However, if there is a clear majority of time that they are healthy, we're entitled to assume they were healthy at that time until we determine otherwise. If you take a look at source number 36, Rav Yitzchak Shmalkes, the Beis Yitzchak, says that explicitly. I'm not going to read it inside because I would rather, I'd rather see vignette number 3. But that is the position that we take. Clear? In terms of that? In terms of the sometimes case? So I hope we've now at least addressed the questions that came up in the chat before that I said we were going to see in vignette number 1 and vignette number 2. Right? The one who is a Shotela Davar Echad, in the event that they really have a pattern of always doing this in that particular situation, that they're muhzak, that they do that, and it's a shtut gadol, it's a real clear sign of being a shoteh, they're assumed to be a shoteh for everything unless we can demonstrate that they are rational in other areas. Somebody who has periods of lucidity and periods of irrationality, when they are lucid, they're not a shoteh. In the event that the most of the time they are healthy, then we can assume that whatever happened with them was during a period of lucidity until we determine otherwise. If it's 50-50, then we're going to need to be really careful. If they want to, let's say, we want to have them execute a divorce, we better make sure that it's done during a time when we assess them and find them to be lucid. In vignette number 3, I'm not going to get to number 4. I realize that. But vignette number 3 is an important question, which we've addressed off and on. And that is the question of how we actually make decisions for somebody who is a shoteh. What system do we use to make assessments? Do we say substituted judgment? We try to do what we think they would have wanted were they lucid. Or do we say best interest, what we think is in their best interest? I'm skipping the vignette just because of time. It'll take me too long to even read it out loud. But both standards exist in society. The secular preference in general in society is for substituted judgment. That is also what we tend to use within halacha. Poskim tend to go in that direction. I brought you two examples of this, Rav Moshe Feinstein and Rav Shlomo Zalman Orbach, who make different arguments but both come to the same conclusion. Source number 37, Rav Moshe Feinstein says, in most cases, the patient has relatives, even father and mother, brothers and the like, and this includes spouses as well. We discussed this in an earlier session, Zevi, and you asked me that, and I checked it out with Rav Schechter, and he said, yes, spouses count as well, who are involved in his treatment, for it is legally their responsibility to a greater extent. If the patient is a baby or an adult who cannot decide, his parents and the whole family may decide. The permission stems from the fact that most patients depend upon their parents' opinion and even upon the family, like brothers and sisters and children, who want what is best for the patient and his family. When there are no relatives, it's certainly better to depend upon the view of the local court. But the key is, the reason we are relying on the family members is because the patient would have wanted them to make the decision. So therefore, we are just following the judgment of the patient. That's Rav Moshe's explanation. Rav Shlomo Zalman gives a different reason in number 38. He says, if the patient lacks capacity so that one cannot discuss this with the patient, perhaps one may rely on the family members who we know clearly desire very much the best interest of the patient, and they can gauge the patient's views and desires in such a situation whether to agree to the treatment or not. They know what the patient would have wanted. And that's the reason why we do this. So we use substituted judgment. I didn't include anything on the sheet for vignette number 4 because I knew I wasn't going to get there. But vignette number 4 was the question of institutionalizing somebody, putting them into a setting where they're not going to be able to fulfill mitzvot, they won't be able to get kosher food. God willing, in our June session, we're going to be talking about treatment against a patient's wishes. And we'll have to talk then about also putting somebody in such a setting without their permission. And maybe we'll throw this into the discussion then. But I knew I wasn't getting to vignette number 4, so I left that out. It's 9 o'clock. For those who need to get off, you can do so. I'm going to stick around, though, to take questions and comments. Thank you very much, everybody. thank you.
Thank you.
Okay. Questions and comments.